Let's move on to case number three. Case number three is that of a 40-year-old mechanic who was at work using a grease gun, and a break in the hose caused the grease to blast into his left index finger. He reports that there was only a little bit of pain and swelling, but was told by his boss that he had to go to the ED to get it checked out. He sees you about 2 hours after the injury occurred and tells you that the pain seems to be getting worse with time. So, Dr. Arkan, this patient has sustained a high-pressure injection injury. What is a high-pressure injection injury, and why is it often an elusive yet potentially devastating diagnosis?
This is potentially a scary case, as you've alluded to. So any liquid, grease or paint or hydraulic fluid under high pressure can cause significant injury. This liquid is under high pressure and it releases when it hits the skin. The fluid triggers an intense inflammatory response that can lead to significant ischemic injury and sometimes can actually go on to, unfortunately, having the patient require an amputation. You get the injury from the nature of the pressure as it dissects out the tissue planes, causing neurovascular compromise. You get injury from the nature of the material, so it can be cytotoxic. And then you can get secondary infection as well. It's elusive because in the early stages, it can look relatively benign. You may not get the story that it's high pressure, so it's really important to be very clear when you're talking to your patients about the mechanism of injury with respect to what happened, and to get from them historically that this was high pressure. Even though it looks relatively benign in the early stages, over time the finger becomes quite edematous, very pale, and can be terribly tender to palpation. And this is also significant because the amputation rates can be as high as 30% with these injuries. Essentially, you need to consider it as a compartment syndrome of the hand until it's proven otherwise. I think the pearl may not be to remember all of the specifics, but recognize that that patient coming in with a high-pressure injury is in a really precarious scenario and to act accordingly.
Okay, so a high-pressure injury can be considered a potential compartment syndrome until proven otherwise, as you mentioned. In our last episode, we discussed compartment syndrome of the leg and some pearls about the six P's of assessment for compartment syndrome. Why is it that compartment syndrome of the hand is considered to be an even more elusive diagnosis than compartment syndrome of the leg?
You may not get the same paresthesias that you do with the limb. The motor deficits may actually be subtle. And you can't reliably measure compartment pressures in the hand. So really, it's a clinical diagnosis. Another good pearl is to have a look at the patient's hand and how they're holding it. And what you may see is the MCPs in extension and the PIPs in slight flexion, taking the pressure off that tendon as best as they can.
Mm-hmm. That's the so-called intrinsic minus position.
Like a claw.
Like a claw. Right.
Hand.
So when they come in with a claw hand, then that's when you should worry about compartment syndrome. Got it. Okay, so Dr. Arkan, how can an x-ray help you out in a patient with a high-pressure injection injury? You know, they come in and they say they got blasted by some liquid on their finger and their finger's a little bit red and a little bit swollen. And we don't normally think about doing an x-ray. Why should we be doing x-rays in these patients?
It may tip you off to the nature of the injury from the fluid. You may see subcutaneous air. And if it's a lead-based liquid, the contrast in the image may give you a hint as to the extent of the injury.
And in terms of how we should manage these patients with the high-pressure injection injury in the ED, what should we be doing with them?
So this is a true surgical emergency. This is a case where you work them up quickly and call your hand specialist at that moment. The definitive management in these is early surgical decompression and debridement.
And Dr. Tate, could you just give us a description of what you do when you take these patients to the OR?
Yeah, they have to have a general anesthetic. You have to follow the path of that injection injury and decompress the fascia around the finger, and you just keep going until it starts to look like normal tissue. You leave it open and splinted and elevated.
And this might be a one case in a career. It's not that common, but the key is to make sure that you recall that it's significant and have the appropriate action.
So the real key to diagnosing this is not to be fooled by seeing just a little bit of erythema and a little bit of swelling if they get there early after the injury. That if you get any history that this was high pressure fluid of any kind that injured them, you've got to assume that this is a high pressure injection injury. Get your surgeon on the line, elevate the limb, start your antibiotics, and get them prepped for the OR. So that's high-pressure injection injuries. Let's move on to our fourth case. Our fourth case is that of a 30-year-old man who was at work on his farm when he punctured the volar part of his index finger with the tip of a dirty tool that day, just prior to seeing you. He comes into the ED because of increasing pain and swelling. On exam, he has an exquisitely tender and swollen finger that he's holding in slight flexion. What are you worried about in this patient in terms of what he's injured or what the possible diagnosis is?
Well, I'm worried about infection with a red swollen finger. And if the puncture wound is near the flexor tendons, then we're worried about a contamination of the flexor tendon sheath, which can lead to tenosynovitis. And one of the things when you're looking at the patient then is they can be holding it in slight flexion. So you're trying to decide, is it just a cellulitis or is it a flexor tenosynovitis? Because the outcomes are different. If it's just a cellulitis, you're going to treat them with splinting and elevation and antibiotics. But if it's a flexor tenosynovitis with involvement of the flexor tendon sheath, it needs to be operated on surgically to decompress it and irrigate it. We leave a drain, actually, and to continue the irrigation. They need admission. Those factors that help to differentiate cellulitis from a tenosynovitis, they both have a red swollen finger, kind of a sausage shape. But with the flexor tenosynovitis, they're exquisitely painful if you try to straighten the finger out. So that's one tip that's quite useful. The other is that if you press over the flexor tendon sheath on the volar surface of the finger, away from where the laceration is, it'll also be very tender, as opposed to maybe just a laceration where it's sore. But, you know, it won't be sore too far away from the laceration itself. So those two factors are really important in helping to make the diagnosis and alert for the emergency doctor to pick that up and give us a call.
Okay, so tenderness along the flexor sheath and severe pain on extension of the finger. Those are really the two things that distinguish it from a simple cellulitis.
Yeah.
There are Canival's four cardinal signs of flexor tenosynovitis. Two of them are what you just mentioned. The four of them are, one is the finger held in slight flexion. Two is a fusiform swelling. Three is tenderness along the flexor sheath. And four is pain with passive extension.
Okay. And the other interesting thing is that you can sometimes get this without a puncture wound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my understanding is that flexor tenosynovitis can be infectious, and most of the ones we see in the emergency department are infectious, and then some of them are inflammatory without any infectious component at all.
But when it's a red swollen finger, we still...
But we still got to assume that it's...
and all that kind of
right,
stuff.
Right, yeah. We assume it's an infection cause until proven otherwise. So Dr. Tate, why is it so important to manage flexor tenosynovitis in a timely manner?
Well, if this is not picked up right away and treated, it can lead to permanent adhesions between the flexor tendons and the sheath, and they'll have a very stiff finger. They won't be able to fully extend or flex, so it's a permanent disability.
How are these patients usually treated?
Well, they need IV antibiotics, splinting and elevation. And sometimes we'll just treat them with IV antibiotics for the first 24 hours. If you're not sure 100%, we usually treat them as a suspicion. And if they're not better after that IV antibiotics for 24 hours, we take them to the OR and explore it because we just don't want to take a chance of missing one of them. But sometimes it's pretty florid when you're seeing them and you don't have to wait the 24 hours. You just know, hey, this is the real thing. And you'd go and admit them. That's why oftentimes for any upper limb infections, we like to hear about them as plastic surgeon as opposed to medicine for admission with IV antibiotics. It's really for this injury that we don't want to miss. So we don't want this type of an injury to be admitted to medicine for IV antibiotics because it needs surgical eyes looking at it so that it doesn't get missed.
So we've just talked about two relatively uncommon diagnoses of the hand. Let's talk about something that's much more common. A 25-year-old, otherwise healthy woman presents to your ED with a 5-day history of increasing swelling and pain around the fingernail of her left third digit. On exam, she has an obvious huge paronychia. So Dr. Arkand, this is, as I mentioned, a very common condition that we see in the ED that's relatively simple to diagnose, but the variety in management strategies I see out there is really quite remarkable. Can you review for our listeners the best management options for paronychia?
Well, I think if you have an early paronychia without abscess, you often can improve the outcome with simple soaks, PO antibiotics, and perhaps some topical antibiotics. But there's limited evidence for this. The key is to understand when you have an abscess that you need an incision and drainage. To do this, you need obviously anesthesia, whether it's lidocaine or potentially marking. Oftentimes, these guys present just before bed because they can't sleep because their fingers are so sore. So personally, I use marking quite often because I think it gives them longer analgesia, and I'm careful about describing that they'll be numb for the length of time that it takes the marking to wear off. But what's important is to understand how to go about doing the IND. So you need to cleanse the nail plate and surrounding skin with your appropriate antiseptic. And you want to complete a blunt dissection with the tip of a sharp instrument or a point of a surgical blade. And you want to elevate the lateral nail fold. You want to enter the sulcus between the lateral nail plate and the lateral epithelium. And usually at this point you get good purulent drainage when the sulcus is entered with the instrument tip. As you're carrying out the procedure, you want to elevate the lateral fold of the skin and irrigate with normal saline using a catheter tip syringe. So again, ensuring that you have good irrigation. The other important point is to ensure that your patient has really good follow-up care and post-procedure care, including soaks to keep the wound open and draining whenever possible.
So when you have a really big paronychia, like in this woman, and let's say you've done an IND and then you've got this big wound that you've opened now, you have a big cavity, how do you deal with those?
You have two choices. You could encourage the patient to soak to keep the wound open, or you could consider putting a wick in. That wick will prevent adhesions and allow the abscess to then slowly heal over time.
And then sometimes the paronychia is so bad that it actually tracks under the nail and even lifts the nail up, the so-called floating nail. How do you deal with those when you know you have pus underneath the nail?
Depending on how things look, you may need to remove the nail plate. Having said that, if you can get away with a small wedge resection of the nail plate, not taking the full nail out, it really depends on the nature of where the abscess is and how far it's tracked over to the ipsilateral side.
Dr. Tate, let's say you've got someone with a paronychiae, and sometimes these paronychiae actually end up involving the pulp of the finger. In other words, they have a felon. Dr. Tate's now going to describe a bit about the pathophysiology of a felon and how we should treat it in the emergency department.
The back of your hand, if you move the skin around it, it really moves easily, whereas at the fingertips, it's quite adherent. And the reason for that is that the skin from the fingertips has to be fairly stable for sensation. So there's a lot of septa between the skin and the underlying bone, and they form little compartments. So if you get an infection in there, it's exquisitely tender and it feels very tense. So those are the clinical features that give you some concern that there's an abscess. And they don't drain well, these felons, and so just treating with IV antibiotics, it just doesn't get better. It's exquisitely painful. People will be back. So what you have to do is decompress those little compartments. It's not an easy thing to do. So if you have the opportunity to just refer them at that stage to the hand surgeon, we'd be happy to see them. Now, if you don't have that opportunity to refer them, what we try to do is preserve the nerves to the fingertip, because that's so important postoperatively. So your centering your incision is going to be where the draining site is, and you need to detach the little septa from the skin to the bone along the whole length of the distal phalanx, not just locally. And that's really the key to having these people settle down in a reasonable time. If you just release some of those bands, then they're going to linger on and they can get necrosis of the pulp and lose the soft tissues of their fingertip and require amputation sometimes too. So the two ideas are trying to preserve the neurovascular bundles, and you're trying to keep your incision away right from the very center of the pulp if you can. You want to have a longitudinal incision. You want to try to avoid the neurovascular bundles, which are on either side of the pulp there. So you're going to try to keep your incision on the periphery of the pulp, either at the tip or the sides. And if it's related to a paronychia, it's often closer to one side or the other. And make sure you do an adequate release so that you don't have to go back. And we usually pack them, and it's important to take a culture, because along with MRSA and that around, sometimes even these little paronychia have MRSA, and it's good to find that out. They're usually admitted for IV antibiotics, elevation, splinting, and dressing changes.
Go ahead and take care of business for me.
The next case is that of a 40-year-old radiologist who comes into your ED on their day off after sustaining an injury while golfing. While golfing, she was going for a long drive, and she hit the turf instead of the ball, resulting in a sudden onset of pain in the palm of the hand. She was tender over the hypothenar eminence, and an X-ray of her hand and wrist appeared normal. So, Dr. Arkan, what diagnosis is this eMERGE doc missing, and how would you manage this patient?
Well, look, this is a very common injury with radiologists participating in their leisure activities on their days off. No, I'm kidding. This is a classic story for a hook of the hamate fracture. So if you listened to this story and looked perplexed, then I'll encourage you to listen further, because this is something that we can very easily miss. So typically, hook of the hamate fractures occur with a fouche, a fall on an outstretched hand with an avulsion of the hook, or more classically, this type of injury occurs when a club or racket or bat is forced into the palm with direct pressure on the hypothenar eminence. The fracture is actually difficult to see on an AP or lateral view of the hand. So the pearl with this is to consider it in your differential, examine the hypothenar eminence, and then order the right X-ray. And you may need to add an extra view, which might be described as a carpal view or a carpal tunnel view or a 20-degree supinated lateral view. So this is a case where you discuss with your radiology colleagues what the next appropriate view should be and add it, and you may actually see a fracture on this view. You also need to understand that this fracture also may be occult, and you may not see them on plain films. So with the right clinical suspicion, you need to consider immobilizing them, and they may need a CT scan or other imaging. So non-union is common with this injury, and sometimes the fractured piece may need to be excised.
Sure. So just to review there, the mechanism of this injury is either this sort of racket or club or bat sort of sports injury to the palm, or a fouche, which is probably the most common upper extremity fracture mechanism we see. So it's important to think about it in these patients who present with fouches who have pain on their hypothenar eminence. And we need to order a carpal tunnel or a carpal view if we don't see it on the plain X-ray, which we often don't. And even then, if you don't see it on that view, if you suspect it highly enough, if they're really tender on that hypothenar eminence, then those patients should be splinted and they may need a CT scan at a later date. And of course, this is also important because there's a high rate of non-union and they might actually need surgery for this.
Yeah, my understanding is it's quite common in professional athletes, baseball players in particular, and oftentimes because of the risk of non-union, if you need to get back playing, some athletes will prefer to have the fracture excised primarily because they're back at their trade earlier than if they wait in an immobilization for 6 weeks and then to decide to have the fracture piece excised.
Let's say you've done your carpal views and you found that this patient has a hook of a hamate fracture. How do you manage them in the emergency department, and how are they managed later on?
So these need to be immobilized, and typically a volar splint with your MC joints in flexion 4th and 5th would be acceptable with a referral to the hand clinic.
And in terms of when they are referred, if they do need surgery, Dr. Arkan, you had mentioned excision of the bone.
Well, typically we wouldn't excise. We'd give it the 6 weeks to see if it's going to be a non-union in a regular patient. And if it didn't heal, then you'd go on and excise that fragment. But initially, you just have them in their splint for their 6 to 8 weeks and see how they made out.
So next time you see a patient with a fouche, what I've always taught is patients with a fouche, you should be looking distal to proximal. You're looking for a scaphoid fracture. You're looking for a distal radius fracture. You're looking for a radial head fracture in adults. In kids, you're looking for a supracondylar fracture. In older people, you're looking for a proximal humerus fracture. And then even with a fouche, you can get a clavicle fracture. And that's usually what I teach my residents in terms of when you know that the patient has had a Fuchs, those are the fractures you should be looking out for. So you can add to that list the hook of the hamate fracture, especially when they're tender on the ulnar side of the hand in the hypothenar eminence, and you seem perplexed why you can't see it on the x-ray.
They are falling all around me. They are falling all around me.
In the last section of this episode, Dr. Tate is going to describe the most common errors that she sees emergency docs do when it comes to hand emergencies.
Often hands, sutures are they're over joints, and they probably should be left in at least 12 days so that you don't have a dehiscence of the wound afterward. So we'd prefer they'd be in a little longer than the usual that you might place on another part of the body. One other point may be that sometimes bleeding is difficult to control when they're partial injuries or the dermis is injured. So really, we just want pressure and elevation. We don't really want to be clamping off anything because the digital artery sits just underneath the digital nerve. So if you're putting a clamp on the or a small snap or mosquito on a digital artery, or even if you think it's a digital vein, it may be an artery. So you could be causing some damage to the digital nerve, or we wouldn't put a suture in those areas, just pressure, elevation, and then skin sutures. One of the things we see sometimes is where people have had an abscess in their hand that's been drained and emerged, and they come back for clinic and it's just not improving enough, and we wonder, is it an MRSA or something more unusual? So it's quite helpful sometimes to have those cultures done from the abscesses in emergency departments. We can refer back to them if they need be. Now, often if it is an MRSA that comes back on the culture, if the wound's getting better, we're not going to treat them with antibiotics. But it's more for the people that are not getting better that we'd like to have that initial culture. Finally, the PIP joint is an interesting structure in the hand. It has to have tremendous flexibility, yet it has to have some stability as well and extension. And if it's immobilized for more than a couple of weeks in extension, there can be permanent changes to the collateral ligaments around it, and it can lead to permanent stiffness in the finger, which can be really disabling and needs a lot of physio and may not even respond to physiotherapy. So even a normal PIP joint that's held in extension for 2 weeks can end up with some permanent deformity. So a general rule is to try not to splint the PIP in extension for more than 2 weeks. So we, again, if you're any concern of the PIP joint or proximal finger fractures and you've immobilized the PIP, you really need to get them be seen and assessed within that two-week period so we can get that joint moving if possible. A good example of this is a mallet finger, whether there's a fracture or just a tendon avulsion. We really want to just immobilize the DIP joint in extension. We never want the splint to extend to the PIP. So for a mallet fracture or a sprain, we want to immobilize that DIP in extension for 6 weeks, and usually we're happy to see them back for follow-up after they've been seen in the emergency department a week later. And usually every week we change the splint for them because it gets sweaty and sometimes it doesn't stay on long enough. We really have to tell people to be religious about keeping that DIP extension for the 6 weeks or they have to start all over again. The only time we'd really immobilize the PIP in extension is if there's a laceration right over the extensor tendon or a boutonniere kind of deformity. And those ones, again, are going to be referred to plastic, so you don't have to worry about them as long as they get in to be seen within 2 weeks.
If you want to do right, home do right, day, do right, woman.
Next, we're going to give you Dr. Tate's best case ever when it comes to hand emergencies.
We had an interesting case that was presented through the emergency department with a young man who's a laborer, and he presented with tingling of his fingertips and pain that had occurred from the day before when he'd been mixing some cement. And we had concerns about why his pain seemed to be much greater than we would see just topically. And when we questioned him further, it turned out that he had some exposure to hydrofluoric acid. And with that information then, we were able to think about how we could deactivate the hydrofluoric acid. And rather than doing injections into the fingertips or pulp, which sometimes you can see in the literature for some of these more massive injuries, really for fingers and hands, you can just put the calcium gluconate gel in a glove, and they can wear that glove on the hand for 24 hours. And he noticed some improvement in the return sensation within a few hours of the emergency department. And we were able to let him go home with gloves in place. As he was a reliable patient, he'd come back if there were any problems. And the next day he did return and still had some sensation loss, but his range of motion was improved, and we could tell that he wasn't going to have any tissue necrosis. It's a rare injury, and it was good to see a good result and a pickup from that history, that kind of numb, tingling feeling to the fingers, which was a little unusual.
Mm-hmm. So hydrofluoric acid, even if you don't see much on the skin, it can really penetrate deep and cause major
significant tissue damage. If it was a whole limb, then we might get into problems with renal failure and needing intramuscular or intra-arterial injections, but not for the hand itself. And also the fact that he had no necrosis 24 hours after his original injury was also a very good sign for him, because usually if you're going to get necrosis, it's within the first 12 to 24 hours.
Well, that about wraps it up for this month's episode. For next episode, we're going to be talking with Dr. Jordan Chenkin, who was with us on our ultrasound episode, and Dr. Jamie Blicker, who's new to emergency medicine cases, and we're going to be discussing procedural pearls and pitfalls. Before we go, I'd like to leave you with this month's quote of the month, and this one is again from Sir William Osler. "Nothing will sustain you more potently than the power to recognize in your humdrum routine, as perhaps it may be thought, the true poetry of life, the poetry of the commonplace, of the plain, toil-worn woman with their loves and their joys, their sorrows and their griefs." So until next time, take it easy.